This is an ABC podcast.
There's that moment when you're at the beach trying to catch a wave, you're waist high up in the water, and you look really hard at the next wave as it rears up, trying to pick your moment. And the wave changes shape and colour as it swells up and curves and reaches over and then crashes. Ray Collins began swimming out to the ocean waves at his local beach with a camera and snapping the waves and catching them in a frozen instant. And when you do that, ocean waves can look really weird, like a mutant rock shelf or like a strange animal. Ray's photographic work has been published in magazines all over the world. Ray Collins has spent his working life in the blue and the black, as he calls it, swimming out in the freedom of the ocean. But he also spent years working in a coal mine way, way below the Earth's surface, where the miners form a kind of protective brotherhood. I called Ray at his home near Wollongong in New South Wales, but the connection wasn't great.
6, 7, 8, 9.
So he moved outside to his back deck, where a coal train went right past his yard.
And because it's a, you know, steelworks and coal community, these things come through every half an hour or whatever.
Is it going to Port Kembla or something?
That is, yes. Yes, it is.
Are you quite close to the beach where you are as well?
Yeah, I am. I'm 300 metres would be probably pretty apt.
So your place is like the most ultra Wollongong place in the world, in other words.
Doesn't get much more gong than that. All right, I think we've got the silence back.
Okay. What do you look for when you swim out with your camera into the water, Ray?
I kind of tend to base myself where a wave ends its journey from a storm thousands of kilometres away, and it will, like when you throw a rock in a pond and the radial spread of those ripples, it's like that on a large scale. And where that meets a coastline, that's where I am to take photos of the end of its journey, which is often spectacular.
So you see yourself as someone capturing the end of some natural process that's begun a long, long time ago and quite a long way away then.
Definitely, yeah. Just to get the final shot, like pushing the button is often the last stage in a process of kind of mapping out, watching the weather, watching the storm, and just picking where you want to be and where you want to meet this energy line, basically.
When is the best time to take the shot of the wave?
Most photographers will tell you it's the golden hour, which is the, you know, the morning or the afternoon, and that's what I tend to favour as well. You just get those dynamic kind of shadows and contrasts and the really rich kind of sunrise or sunsets.
To me, it seems like you're making waves or water look strange again. Like some of the images you've got, the waves look like sort of a blue-green toffee that's being pulled out of a saucepan or something like that. Is that your intention to make us look at nature again?
Yeah, I tend to represent the kind of more dark and ominous kind of tones and making liquid almost look like solid as it stands up. And I really want the viewer to kind of question it and bring themselves to the picture.
What kind of shapes do you think you see when you're snapping these images of waves curling around like that?
Oh, it's what you see and what you feel. Like I'm floating, waiting for something to happen. I'm sitting in the dark, waiting for the sun to come over the horizon. And often I've scaled down a cliff or something, and I'm waiting for a wave to hit the cliff and go back out to sea. So the next wave meets it and they go, the two energy sources meet and they go straight up, which gives you these absolutely crazy pinnacles and triangles. I never really know what to expect, and that's kind of the beauty of it.
Yeah, sometimes they do look like cliff overhangs or something you'd see in Central Australia a long way from the water.
Totally, yeah. It's funny because I get a lot of people buying my work from Switzerland and stuff, and they're like, oh, it reminds me of the mountains around home. And, you know, that's something you could never intend when you start out taking photos at the beach, you know.
Are you bumping into other creatures when you're out there in the water?
The creatures of my mind are much worse than anything else. Yeah, so, you know, you kind of just have to separate what's going on under the water and just be present on top of the water. Yeah, we see big animals moving in the water, but you know, I think they're just going about their business just as I am as well. And that's the hope that I cling on to when I'm in the water.
Do you feel their presence when they're there, or do you see them as sort of shadows moving around you?
you're bobbing on the surface, and when an animal, whatever it is, you can feel the water moving, and it's an unnatural thing because it goes against the flow of what you've been sitting in for the last 20 minutes or 30 minutes. So you definitely, you're not alone, put it that way.
I always say that it's one of the great things about an Australian childhood, if you live on the coast, is the beach is your birthright. Was that you as a kid? Were you always in the surf?
The ocean was kind of my refuge, yeah. I was in the surf from the earliest days of my life. My earliest memories were kind of hanging on my mum's back and her swimming under waves and just feeling the weightlessness. And there's no better place to grow up, and the lessons you can learn from the ocean, that's kind of shaped me as a human being, I think.
I always find the fizz of the surf just the most delicious thing about it.
Oh, yeah. You never feel worse when you leave. Sometimes it's a struggle to go in, or it's a bit cold or windy, but once you've done it and you come out, it's like it's a reset for your day.
You had a pretty rocky childhood, Ray. Your dad took his own life when you were a kid. What did that mean for the family growing up?
Well, it kind of... Yeah, like losing my father, it was, the male influence in my life, and that was pretty hard. And my mum did her very best to look after myself and my brother and sister. But, the input from one parent can't really count for the masculine kind of input that you need as a boy growing into a teen and then into a man. So, yeah, it was pretty rocky times, and I feel like we were caught in a little loop of mum trying to start again, and we ended up moving around a lot, and I went to almost 10 different schools growing up, so I was really uprooted and never really had that grounding stability in my life, and I found that no matter where I was, no matter what school I went to or what was happening, whether it was, tough times, or we were eating baked beans on toast for the fourth time that week, whenever I went to the ocean, it was like, this is my home. This is where I'm safe.
Do you have to step up a bit and become a bit of a surrogate dad for your younger siblings?
Yeah, totally. I was the eldest. So, I was kind of the parent in a lot of ways. But it's not like I wish it was different, because I wouldn't be who I was or learn the lessons or gain the experience, because that's the only way you can learn lessons is from going through the stuff. So I've learned to embrace it recently.
You would have had to have learned to shoulder a lot more responsibility than a lot of other kids your age then. Do you get used to shouldering that responsibility?
I feel like maybe my childhood was kind of not as long as it could have been if I was in a regular family, but that's me comparing myself to a reality that didn't exist. So yeah, for sure, I was shouldering it, and I was the de facto parent, but that's just how it is.
Did the family settle down somewhere eventually?
Yeah, we were put on the government housing list for the Housing Commission, and we could have been put in any place in New South Wales. And I remember her going the extra mile, and they found us a place in Bulleye. And Bulleye it's paradise. It's where the mountains meet the sea. And when we moved to this Housing Commission place, that was my stability through the whole of high school.
The school you went to, could you see the surf from your school?
Yeah, Bulleye High School. I tell you what, it's a special, special place. We had surfing for sport, swimming at the local rock pool, so we could see Sandon Point breaking from the English classrooms. So I always had to pop in and see the English teacher about certain things during my day to look out her window. So yeah, we were real lucky there.
What were the expectations of you going to that school, or for the young men of your age at that time? Was there still that expectation, once you get out of school, you're going to work at the steelworks or in a mine or something like that?
Yeah, like I'm 38 now, but I have the ability now to kind of feel like an old man, basically. Like I can look back, and see, it was a different era. This whole area is built on the back of coal mining and coal mining communities. And a lot of guys, when they left school, they would get an apprenticeship or get a trade, and either be a boilermaker or doing something at the steelworks or go underground and cut coal. They were pretty easy paths to kind of walk into for sure.
Explain to me why you wanted a job at the mines in particular. Why there?
Well, I left school and I worked in the health system at Bulleye Hospital, actually. I was a wardsman there and I was assisting the nurses, just, you know, moving patients around and just being a general help in any way I could. And one of the other wardsmen, he introduced me to the world of coal mining and he kind of gave me an inside scoop on a guy to ring. And he said, don't worry, he's going to sound pretty grumpy, but don't take it personally. His name is also Ray, and he's a 60-ish-year-old Scottish guy who, you know, has been mining since he was a boy. And I wanted to leave the hospitals just so I could get, you know, double the money for the same amount of time. So I rang this guy, and I was pretty shocked when he first answered because he just basically grunted. And then I was like,
you didn't try the "Hey, I'm called Ray, you're called Ray" sort of thing.
Well, it's funny, Richie, because I had 3 months of ringing him, so I tried every like
3 months of ringing him
daily,
to ask him for a job in the mines.
Exactly that. So to run it by would be, "Hey, Ray, it's Ray." And he would say, "Stop calling, like you're annoying me." And I would like, "Okay, I'll talk to you tomorrow, mate. No worries." Because my mate, the wardsman, told me, like, don't be put off by him. Like, it's a gruff exterior, but he's like a nice guy inside. And yeah, so eventually, after constant nagging, he was just like, "Oh, come tomorrow at 5 a.m. Don't be late," and hung up on me. And I was like, "Oh wow, I think this is it. I think this is the thing that I do now."
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So after 3 months of begging and pleading and banging on his door, you were in.
I was.
So tell me what happens when you go underground for the first time.
Well, you know, being a young man in my very early 20s and fronting up to work on that first day, the average age of a coal miner in New South Wales is 55. So it's an old boys club. There's a lot of manly men who love their sport, love drinking any kind of alcohol and showing up to work and getting it done, basically. So it's really, really intimidating. I had no kind of skills that would transfer to mining either, so I was definitely a clean skin and definitely learning everything new for the first time. So basically, you walk into the bathhouse, you get totally naked, you walk onto the other side of the bathhouse and you put your overalls on and you get your respirator and your hat and your belt and your tools and you stand in a cage and the cage goes directly down for about 8 minutes and that's a kilometer below the Earth's surface. And
a kilometer down underground.
And that's where you start your day.
So what happens when you get all the way to the bottom?
Well, then you start your journey to the work site and you could be working up to 20 kilometers into the mine. So you have a kilometer of earth above you and you're 20 kilometers into a tunnel. And it's, if you spend too much time thinking about that, it can kind of undo your mind a little bit, I think.
And how do you get to the work then?
You get in a rubber tired vehicle or on rail, depending where you're working. So if you can imagine like a Hummer, a Humvee that they use in the military where you can pile guys in the back, it's basically one of those. And you sit shoulder to shoulder with 8 guys on one side and you're staring at another 8 guys looking back at you.
Ray, what's the air down there like?
It's dark, it's dusty, and it can be incredibly hot or freezing cold depending where you are, because that circuit of air gets sucked down from the surface from outside and does a full cycle through the whole mine to keep everyone ventilated, and then it goes back out of the mine.
So it's super cold when it gets down to the bottom, and then it sort of finds its way through and it heats up as it goes through all the network of tunnels then?
And the further you are in, the hotter it is. Yes, it's, that's exactly right.
What does it smell like?
Diesel. It smells like diesel fumes. Whatever anyone else is doing underground, you smell it. You smell tires on rocks and machines cutting into things. You kind of get these sulfuric rotten egg gas smells as well. And it's not that pleasant, huh? You're trudging through mud and smelling rotten egg gas. Like, hey, where do I sign up?
How about the underground itself? Like, is there an earthy smell down there as well?
Yeah, it's a real earthy smell for sure. It's like, I don't know, the essence of earth, really, because that's where you are and you're surrounded by it.
There's no tree roots down that far, are there?
No. You're just in a coal seam, which in a lot more time from now, thousands of years, will one day be diamonds, I guess.
So once you've gotten to the point where you start work, what do you do then?
So once you're set up, you'll have to get all your tools, and you're constantly rolling and unrolling hoses and setting up like air drills and jack picks. And there's a lot of just manual labor where machines kind of can't get into these little tiny little crevices. So you can often be, you know, on your hands and knees moving heavy stuff around and breaking up stuff into smaller stuff and then moving that stuff around.
Can you have conversation, or is it just too damn noisy down there?
Both. When it's noisy, like when the work's on, it's on. But when there's downtime, there's certainly downtime, and there's a lot of dark humour and a lot of shit talking, as you know, Australian males have a tendency to do.
It's the most authentic expression of male affection in this country.
Totally, yeah. The more good friends you are, the worse the talk is.
That's right. The worst things you say to one another. That's us, isn't it?
Totally.
So tell me about the brotherhood that operates down there. How does that work?
Well, underground, your fellow workers, your brothers, yeah, that's all you got. If there's an accident, if there's a fire, if there's someone gets hurt, you can't ring an ambulance, you can't call a fire brigade. Like, you're it. You're the front line. And that kind of reliance on each other creates a certain kind of connection to the people that you work with. And you never lose that. The guys, I've left the pits years ago now, but the guys that I spent, you know, this 13 years with, we still have that kind of known experience that we've shared.
So you're saying sort of underneath all that joking, there's this deep well of seriousness under all of that.
Totally. And respect. Yeah, you're vulnerable. And like I said, you have to rely on your brothers under there. So it forces you into this kind of different dimension of friendship, I guess.
I suppose there's, alongside that, there's, you know, ritual and jargon and history and all that sort of stuff. What does a new kid like you do to learn how to fit in?
You watch and act and try and play the part that you're watching. It's a strange world. The language is different under there. So, like, if you can't say, oh, go down the road and get the thing, it's like, oh, you got to go in by or out by. And then there's these cut-throughs. There's basically cities underground. There's traffic lights, petrol stations, places where you eat. All of these things are like spread out under Appin and Campbelltown. And you would never know if you drove your car through southwestern Sydney that you're actually driving over Swiss cheese of different tunnels underneath you.
How many of the workforce are actually just chipping away literally at the coalface?
There's two classes of people underground. There's the pit people, who are employed by the people who own the coal mine, and they're kind of like the top shelf fighter pilots. And then you have contractors, who are the non-skilled, just muscle work, basically.
And was that you to start with, Ray?
Yeah, no one starts with the creamy jobs. Everyone starts at the bottom generally. The guys who are at the coalface, the pit guys, they will cut. And when you're cutting into virgin coal, the cavity that you leave behind you is somewhat weakened. So they'll put in a row of support, which is like bolting it to the sides and the top. And then you have to come in and set props, kind of like a telegraph pole, maybe a bit thinner. and you would grab a prop with your mate and put it on your shoulder, carry it from wherever to wherever, and stand it up or cut it to size, and then drive wedges into it to press the floor down and the roof up to prevent collapse.
Doesn't sound a huge amount of difference between, you know, like the work of the sappers in the First World War, you know, digging military tunnels.
As much as technology has advanced, some things just, they stay the way they are, and that's that. And when you're kind of learning about it, you're just like, oh, this is how it's done. And then, yeah, it's not until you think about it later and you're like, wow, that's incredible what we're doing. That's so kind of old-fashioned in a way.
So what happens when it's lunch break? Does everyone down tools at the same time and sit around and give each other a hard time?
Yeah, there's a lot of that for sure. But yeah, so if you're a contractor, you don't sit with the other guys because they have their, like, you know, sparkling table and fresh water and all that. So
what?
Yeah.
There's first class dining down there and second class dining?
It's segregation, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So we would sit, you know, wherever we were working and put one of the props down and just have some lunch on that, and colorful commentary of how the day is progressing and how the guys are in the crib room eating as well. So, you know, it's all in good fun and there's no real kind of bad vibes under there.
But by the time you pick up a sandwich and then put it in your mouth, is the sandwich sort of half black and covered in soot?
It totally is. Yeah. It totally is. Fruit as well. Like if you peel an orange with black fingers. Yeah. I reckon I ate a lot of coal inadvertently.
When you did get to work at the coalface, what was the work like?
Well, I felt like I'd graduated because that's the race that you run when you're under there. That's the finish line, is to get to one of those jobs where you're at the coalface, literally and metaphorically. So you're watching picks on these huge heads rotate and cut into the coal, and it's firing bits of rock and sparks and all kinds of stuff. And you're standing so close to something that's so powerful and so violent, but you're kind of safe. Even though you're 6 feet away, you're watching rocks get cut. And then you're straight behind it with a big drill that's as tall as I am. And that hydraulically drills into the roof, which allows you to set the bolts in to kind of prevent collapse.
You've got gas seeping out there, don't you, when you're drilling into that coal face?
That is right. Some of the really dangerous gases, they're colourless, odourless, and tasteless. So they're called COT gases, COT. And methane is one of those. So you're in a constant tightrope of not having methane dilute with the air, because methane is highly explosive. And if the gas quantity gets between 5 and 15%, that can cause an explosion. And if there's an explosion anywhere underground, the whole mine is going to feel that. And it's happened in this area. It's happened in Bulleye. And every law and every rule and everything you have to do underground is written by the blood of the coal miners who paid with their lives. So, yeah, the Bulleye disaster, there was hundreds of men and boys killed and whole families wiped out. You know, like, imagine a family losing their father and son and their uncle and grandfather. Like, that was the reality for people in Bulleye. And even up into the 70s, where there was the Appin disaster, which was a buildup of gas and then an ignition source again. So, really is dangerous.
What's going to be the ignition source? No one's smoking down there, are they?
No, that would be an instant dismissal, and you would never work in the coal fields again if you had a lighter under there. But an ignition source could be one of the machines, one of the diesel machines could overheat and catch fire. Mainly mobile machinery would make that possible. So
you don't have a canary down there anymore, do you?
Well, the Canary developed into a digital gas monitor. It basically is the same thing, but you're getting readouts consistently and constantly, and you're always checking it too.
So at the end of the shift, what's it like then, Ray?
It's pure elation. When you get into the drift runner, the mobile transport to leave the mine, it's the best feeling. You crawl in, you're sweaty, and you put a big jacket on. Even though it's hot, you know it's going to be cold on the way out because you've got that intake of fresh, cold air, especially in winter, just rushing past. So you wrap up yourself and you just hold on, because on the way out, the drivers, they're not very slow. They're very slow and very gentle on the drive in, but on the way out, it's foot to the floor.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So, Ray, what do you look like when you come to the surface at the end of a day's work down in the coal mine?
You are a set of eyes and vibrant white teeth. Everything else is black. It's black in your ears. It's black around your eyes. It's black in your hair, in your neck, everywhere.
So how do you get all that off anyway?
Well, this goes back to the brotherhood, doesn't it? It's where 200 naked men are rubbing each other's backs and getting spots that you can't get. So that kind of shows the, you know, kind of relationship that everyone has under there.
Well, you got to clean each other in order to get all that stuff off.
Right? Yeah, really, yeah.
And then what do? You go to the pub after that?
That would be the first point of call for about 80% of the workforce. Yes, and there was a time where that was the thing to do. It's people knocking off night shift, going to the pub at 8 o'clock in the morning and having a schooner. And it seems so odd, but it really is. It's their 5 o'clock. It's no different to, you know, a carpenter going to the pub after work.
Is that because you kind of need a point of transition between the mine and home?
I think that's what it would be. Yeah. For me, I would prefer to go to the ocean. That was my main focus when I got out of that dirty coal mine.
Are you guys a bit like police or media people? Are you sort of hard to be around at parties? Do you sort of congregate together and talk shop talk and insider talk with one another when you gather?
Oh man, it's frustrating for non-coal miners. If there's a gathering of 12 people at a backyard party, there's guaranteed to be more than one coal miner, and then they start with their jargon that no one else understands. It would be pretty frustrating, and I see a lot of friends who aren't in the mines when the coal mining talk starts just roll their eyes and like, oh, here we go kind of thing. So yeah.
Have you ever injured yourself down there?
Yeah. I was driving one of these diesel-powered machines, which is kind of like a tractor that you can pick stuff up with on the front, but it's really low because it can't be tall in the mines because the roof height is only 2.5 meters high. So it's long and wide, and I was driving it in a part of the mine where I was by myself. I was about 15 to 18 kilometers in, and I couldn't see over the front, so I had to open my cabin and get out and walk around to check the load that I was picking up or dropping off. And as I did that, I kind of fell into a hole. I guess like I didn't see, it may have had a bit of water over the hole, and the hole was probably a foot deep, and my leg just kind of buckled underneath me and made this not very nice kind of cracking and pop noise. I was buckled and just on my back wondering what just happened to me.
Was anyone around to help?
No. I was alone and kind of a bit scared, actually, wondering what this meant for me, wondering what was going to happen next.
You obviously couldn't walk on that, whatever had happened to your leg.
No. I kind of crawled back to the cabin and just had to wait because I was in so much pain and my leg kind of wasn't working, so I couldn't really use any of the foot controls. So I just thought, well, I'm on a road where someone will eventually pass me, probably towards the end of the shift. So my best bet is just to stay calm and wait. And I did that.
How long did you wait for?
It's hard to know because seconds feel like minutes and minutes feel like hours in those kind of times. I just remember thinking, well, you're going to be fine. Like you're not going to die, but just breathe through the pain and wait. And that's what's going to happen. So I feel like it was maybe an hour or two. One of my colleagues seen my headlamp and he came over to see like what was happening. And instantly he just jumped up back in his machine and took off and called the ambulance. And yeah, that was a bumpy ride out too. In the back of the ambulance.
When you say an ambulance, is it an ambulance or is it just one of those Humvees? What does an ambulance mean?
it's one of the Humvees that's had the 8 seats pulled out and they've got a stretcher in there basically. And they've got, the Penthrine whistle and first aid and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I remember just being horizontal in that and taking the hour trip out and feeling every bump and every pothole and just wondering like what's going to happen, because you don't want to go against the grain under there. And if you're injured, you kind of can't work and you can't pull your weight. And that's noted by the bosses. So
were you trying to underplay your injury then?
The thought ran through my mind, but this was too big to hide, I felt.
So once you got out, Ray, what did the doctors say about your leg?
So I had a grade 3 complex tear on my lateral meniscus on my right leg, and the tear wasn't a clean tear. It was very jagged and very kind of torn and not very neat. So I was booked in for surgery to get that squared away. Then it was just me sitting on the couch wondering how to fill my time for the next couple of weeks or months.
Were you able to go back to that life? Could you have gone back to work after that kind of an injury?
It was hard to say because I had some months of rehab coming up. So I was on compensation wages, which is about maybe half what you would normally get. And they kind of don't want you back until you're fit for duty again. So going back underground in this first instance wasn't in my immediate kind of future. It was getting through this next block of time with this new, adjustment period.
So how were you faring going through that period of not working and being in rehab?
It was a pretty low point, to be honest. Just kind of sat on the lounge and kind of drank beers in the Arvos and just ballooned out to about 115 kilos. That was it. And it kind of got to a point where I was like, all right, you've done this enough. Like, this isn't in your best interests. You got to do something. And I couldn't really do anything physical, which I was used to doing, surfing and swimming and all of that stuff. So I knew I had to do a different kind of challenge. And I thought I would try and do something like a mental kind of challenge or something that wouldn't be affected by the physical state I was in.
So this is when you got a camera.
Well, I felt I was creative and I always had this inkling that I'd like to try photography. I would look at my brother, who is like a really good web designer and animator, and my sister, who is like in the creative arts and singing and, very musically orientated. And I was just thinking like, I wonder what my like thing is. And I thought, well, I'll just give this a shot. It'll kill some time and I have time. So I remember thinking, all right, I'm going to do it. I called a cab because I couldn't drive because it was my right leg and I couldn't use accelerator or brake. And I got the cab to take me to Harvey Norman and went inside and looked at a camera and thought, well, that black one looks like a professional one. That looks like what the guys use. That looks like it. So I'll take that one. And that was it. That was my entry point to photography.
Was that a bit of a big layout for a guy who's going through rehab on half wages?
It was a huge gamble, but it was like, what other choice do I have? So, yeah, I threw down a couple of $1,000 and I just found this new little outlet. It was amazing. I started kind of just learning how the buttons work and taking photos of my dog. She was just the best little muse to have. She was a staffie, and I could just position it anywhere. And she preferred the sun, so that was pretty easy. She helped me learn how shutter speed and aperture and ISO and how the basics of photography work.
See, that's the title of your autobiography right there. My Staffie was my muse. I think that's it right there, right?
Oh, yeah, she was a once-in-a-lifetime pet. I think about her every day, and, yeah, she was a good one.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So from there, going from dog photography to the ocean, wow.
Yeah, things were progressing with my rehab. I'd been going, you know, twice a week to the physio and going to workers' comp meetings and seeing doctors and specialists and surgeons. And the physiotherapist recommended that I get back. He said swimming, and I think maybe he might have thought in a pool. But once I heard swimming, I thought, well, that sounds like I can go back in the ocean again. So I thought, well, what happens if I combine this new hobby of photography with my kind of one true love, the ocean? And that was the turning point where I made my next investment, which was a water housing, which is basically like a box that you slide your camera into, and it has buttons on the outside so you can use the functions of the camera but keep it dry, and it clips down and has O-rings on it so it can be submerged. Looking back, I didn't have any plan, and there was no real kind of too much thought on what I was trying to achieve, but looking back, that was one of the biggest turning points in my life.
So how much was the role of chance in all of this when it came to photographing waves? And were you just snapping around? And was there a moment when you sort of went snap and caught a wave and went, oh, that's it. That's it right there.
I've had a few of those moments, to be honest.
That's true happiness when you have those moments.
It's just gentle corrections, I feel like. It's just like, oh, you feel like you're not walking down the path properly, and you just get pulled in a little direction. You're like, okay, this is just steering me this way or this way. So, yeah, it happened a lot. It happened very, very early in image making for me. So, yeah.
I don't know. This is getting terribly zen right now, but was it just like giving yourself over and trusting the ocean to take you where you needed to be?
That has been my way of thinking my whole life. So having a camera now didn't change that. So when you're in something so big where you have no control, you have to give away any kind of overriding control to something much bigger than you. That's been my philosophy in the ocean, and I guess in life in a lot of ways. And it's easy to say that now looking back, but at the time, that's exactly what I was doing. I was just surrendering myself to what the waves were doing.
It's just funny you say this, Ray, because I've just been talking to Julia Baird. She's written a book about the ocean and also finding awe, about being in the right frame of mind to be awestruck by things, I suppose. That's what this is reminding me of.
Yeah, man. I live for those moments, and they're pretty frequent when you spend a lot of time around nature.
So how ambitious were you then as a photographer at that point?
Well, I would look at the photos when I got home, and I would think, wow, that looks like a shot that I would see maybe in a magazine or something, but not knowing like much, just that, oh, that's a connection I've made. That's a really nice looking thing. And I remember telling my sister, oh, my ambitions, and they were to get a photo published in a magazine. And I wasn't fussed on what magazine or what size photo. I would have been happy with a postage stamp size image somewhere in the back of the magazine buried behind all the news. So I told her, I'm going to set myself a target of getting a photo published in 12 months. And she held the secret for me. And that was my driving ambition for that first year.
And how did you go?
It's safe to say that my expectations were exceeded. I actually got the cover of Australian Surfing Life about 8 weeks after that conversation with my sister. So to be totally honest, even when I'm a very, very old man, I'll never forget walking into Winoona News Agency and seeing a photo of my friend, his name's Michael Hopkins, and he wasn't like a professional surfer or a big name full of sponsors or anything. And Australian Surfing Life put my image of him on the front cover, and I'll never, ever forget that. That's one of those moments that's burnt into my mind, and it's another one of those gentle little pushes in the right direction.
Were you back down the mine at that point?
I balanced coal mining and photography for about 7 years. So I had my black life, which was hanging with the boys and talking shit and making fun of each other and working in dusty and dark conditions. And then I had this other life where I'll be in the outdoors and looking at blue, vast expanses of ocean and watching the sunrise. And if I tried to tell my surfing friends about the mines or the mining friends about surfing, it was just too foreign for a lot of the people to understand unless they did both.
Would they have thought you were up yourself as well? Was there a danger of that?
Oh, yeah. Whatever you say, you're going to be tarred with some kind of brush underground as well. So,
which is saying something when you're that covered in soot, being tarred with a brush on top of the soot. That's bad.
It's true.
So how come you put the camera down for a year?
Well, I felt like I was chasing surfers around. The career of photography was kind of starting to gain some momentum. And I knew that it would be foolish to leave the mines, leave that weekly check. And so I just thought, well, I'll just keep shooting for fun and I'll just keep just learning. I mean, that's all I want to do in life. And so I just kept learning about photography. And I remember getting really disillusioned with trying to deal with other people and maybe egos of some surfers, like, because I was shooting, you know, professional surfers. I was getting covers of magazines. I was getting paid to travel and shoot overseas by this stage. So I just felt like I needed to step back a bit and just refocus and reframe what I actually want to do. And there was a number of things happening in my life at the time. I felt like I just needed a reset. I just needed to be pulled in the right direction again. So, yeah, I didn't shoot a photo pretty much for all of 2012. I just went about my life and did other things and kind of not gave up that career of photography, but almost in a way kind of I did do that, yeah.
So what was your way back?
Well, you got to understand it's so easy to envision this looking back with hindsight, but at the time it was such a really rough time again. I feel like I needed to do a lot of internal work on myself and I needed a lot of personal kind of development because I was, I don't know, just really stagnant. And I felt like my old ways of thinking, you know, growing up in the government housing and having to survive all the time, I feel like those kind of programs, if you will, were outdated. And I'd kind of outgrown them. So I looked really hard at myself with total honesty, and I felt like it was maybe time to stop drinking alcohol. If you look at my family, like my family tree, my DNA, my mum's side, she was the 13th child from immigrants from Russia. And I think 7 or 8 of her brothers and sisters died of alcoholism or complications from alcoholism. And my father, who we've spoken about, took his own life. And alcohol was really rife in that side of the family too, which there was more deaths. So, like, I felt like I think I'm different and I feel like I have this knowledge. There's no way I'm going to go down the path of any of these family traditions, but you know what? I had to just think, well, no, like this is in your kind of programming. So I made a decision on the 30th of November in 2012 to not drink anymore and to spend that time doing other things. If you remember what I said about the best times to shoot is the golden hour, and that is the first hour in the morning and the last hour in the afternoon. And it's an Australian tradition to go to the pub in the afternoon. So there goes that opportunity. And then you're generally hungover or feeling not the best in the morning. So there goes that opportunity. Now, I filled those spots of going to the pub and going out and partying. I filled those spots with going to the ocean. And it was very, very therapeutic to be making images again and not dealing with professionals, just dealing with myself and the ocean and the waves. It was a great time in my life.
You were talking there about your life in the black and your life in the blue. And it just got me thinking that you've spent your life below the surface of things, you know, down deep underneath things.
Yeah. Well, if you subscribe to the fact that we're all the product of our environment, I feel like, yeah, for sure. And then maybe you can see in my work almost, you know, coal or mountainous underground looking kind of ominous waves. So, yeah, I think that was a reflection of what I was experiencing in the mines and in the ocean at the time.
What do you see when you're photographing the ocean that you want everyone else to see?
What I see when I'm photographing the ocean, I generally try not to put too much emphasis on getting a certain style of shot. I kind of have to know that I've done what I can. I'm here. I've arrived. I've put my wetsuit on. I've put my fins on. I've set my camera up. I've done all the hard work. Now I just have to wait and let it unfold and just document it. Just be there and just document it. And I guess what I want to show to people is, although my images can look big and scary and ominous, that the ocean really is such a delicate place. And we, all of us, all of humanity, we rely on it for our quality of life. So yeah, I want to show just how delicate it can be and how fragile it can be, so we can, you know, kind of help preserve it. So my work now isn't a memory in the future of how it used to be. I want it to stay pristine and clean.
It's been so great hearing you talk about your life in the black and in the blue, Ray. Thank you so much.
No worries.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.